We're very thankful to the Heavenly Father for providing the speakers for our convention, and I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Brother Ken to you. You know, we love all of the brethren very dearly, but those elders that have been in the Lord's service for many decades, we have a special affection for, and those that have been faithful in holding up the divine plan and the standard of truth so loyally, and certainly Brother Ken and Sister Virginia are among those that rate so highly in our hearts and in our minds. So we're thankful that Brother Ken has consented to serve and share a little bit with us as the closing talk of our convention. His title is What's Happening in Israel? So we started our convention with what's going on in 2005, and now we're closing our convention by microscoping in on the nation of Israel and what God is doing there. And certainly I'm sure Ken will bring us a little bit more of a vision of what our expectation is as well. Brother Ken.
Thank you for those kind remarks, Brother David. And it's a joy for Sister Virginia and I to be with you. And we've enjoyed the convention very much. The handouts, there's actually two parts to them. One is a little handout on Israel. And the other is something that I put together a few years ago, Failure is Never Final. I intended it to use it in connection with the panel discussion yesterday, but there wasn't time. So whenever the chairman walks up, wherever I'm on Israel, I'm going to stop and just read this because I feel it's far more important for you to leave the convention with these sentiments. On the handout, we will be dealing with everything, but on the last back of it, you notice the state of Israel doesn't have the name Israel on the back. It says Palestine. Now, if anybody is kidding themselves that the Palestinians will be satisfied with a part of the land of Israel, Gaza and the West Bank, they're really kidding themselves, because on every Palestinian map, every map that is printed in an Arab country, you can find the word Israel on it. They all have the name Palestine right smack across the whole of the land of Israel. As I was saying, we've appreciated the convention very much. Well, Bob was talking, and he mentioned Philippi and Lydia and the place where prayer was wont to be made, and how that the singing of hymns at times revives our soul. My mind went back to my conscientious objector days in camp when we were... I was at a camp that was about 2,000 feet from the Pacific Ocean. And one late afternoon, I was very discouraged, and when I did at times like that, I'd go for a walk and prayer. And as I was walking towards the coastline of the Pacific, I found the path, and I took the path up to the top of. And here I was overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and the waves were coming in high, and then as they crashed against the shore and the cliffs, they just went into 1,000 drops. And when they were all, this foam was all reflecting the golden hue of the setting sun. And I found the place where prayer was wont to be made. And I just sat on the cliff and sang out loud hymns to the glory of the Lord. And what a revival that was. And I returned to that place often. And I was touched by the testimony meeting. Different brethren were giving experiences in the harvest work. And it impressed me, as I have said so often, that no one group, no one class, no one individual can do all of the Lord's work. And I was thinking of Fort Worth. You know, it's not mentioned very much. And I don't happen to be a Fort Worth fan. But their efforts have probably brought more people into the truth in the time that they've been active than any other efforts of the brethren. So I find it a thrill to be able to pray for the harvest reapers the world over, in every group, class, and all the individuals. Now, what's happening in Israel? Our talk will be in the spirit of dialogue from two standpoints. From about the first standpoint, from about 1960, Israel's place in the plan of God has become a controversial issue. I can remember when all Bible students believed that Israel would be a blessed nation. In many scriptures that I use, I'll just mention two on this. One is in Isaiah, the 27th chapter, beginning with verse 6. He that is God shall cause them that come of Jacob, and Jacob is natural Israel, to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and what? Fill the face of the world with fruit. Isn't that beautiful? Those of Jacob, natural Israel, will take root and shall blossom and bud and fill the world with fruit. And then another scripture is very precious to me, is Micah 5, this 7th verse. The preceding verses are speaking about the final invasion of Israel. And then Israel is delivered, and in verse 7 it says, and the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as the showers upon the grass that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men. Isn't that beautiful? Israel will be like a dew, gentle truth, and showers of truth to the world of mankind. They, working with the ancient worthies, will be blessers, the agencies of blessing the world of mankind. The second standpoint that our talk will be a dialogue is that I will be dealing with some future aspects of prophecy concerning Israel. And I offer these in the spirit of dialogue. And as I always say, if it doesn't work out the way I feel the scriptures show it's going to work out, it'll be better. Now, what's happening in Israel? Well, let's get back to basics. Brother David, could I have a glass of water? Let's get back to basics. The Abrahamic promise. Actually, there's three parts of that promise. In thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Secondly, the seed through the lineage of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, would be given the land of Canaan forever. And the land of Canaan's name was changed to the land of Israel. And thirdly, the promise that he that blesses the seed of Abraham will be blessed, and he that curses the seed of Abraham will be cursed. You know, Sister Virginia and I have been having a wonderful experience. We have the new Israel video that's for Christians, and we've been going around the country and showing it. And usually, not always, but usually there's at least 100 public and sometimes up to 300. And 99% of the public are active born-again Christians because they're so enthusiastic about Israel. And I start out the service with the Abrahamic promise and the blessing. Thank you, David. The promise blessing, he that blesses Israel. And they'll repeat it out loud as I'm mentioning it. They are so enthused about Israel and that there's a blessing for those who bless the seed of Abraham, and there's a curse for those who curse the seed of Abraham. Now, first, a brief history for background. In 1917, there's the Balfour Declaration. And then this was ratified by the League of Nations in 1921, and Israel was given a mandate over the Holy Land to prepare the Holy Land, which was from the Mediterranean to all of what is now Jordan, as a homeland for the Jewish people, a nation for the Jewish people. In 1922, for reasons we won't go into, Britain chopped off three-quarters of that land, which is now the nation of Jordan, and the League of Nations revised their mandates to just cover one-quarter of this land for the nation, future nation of Israel. But something happened. Oil was discovered in the meantime in the Arab states. And Great Britain, being an imperialistic nation, who are they more interested in? The Jews having a homeland in Palestine and the Holy Land, or the Arab from the oil from the Arab states? They wanted the friendship of the Arabs so they could have the oil. So they reneged on their mandate. And in 1939, we had the white paper, British white paper, that actually stopped legal immigration of Jews to Israel. The Jews were locked out of Israel. The Holocaust began. They had no place to flee. 6 million were slaughtered. And after World War II, the nation's guilt-ridden, passed the UN resolution, partition resolution, that gave Israel a little sliver of the land that was promised in the Balfour Declaration. And in that connection, we're going to read Joel, the third chapter, verses 1 through 3. For behold, in those days, and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage, Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And the Hebrew word for parted my land could very well be petitioned my land. The Lord is very angry with the nations. You know, it's interesting. In Revelation, it gives the Lord's anger, and the reason for Armageddon is basically because of the persecution of spiritual Israel. But here in the Old Testament, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, they're gathered to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, they're gathered to Armageddon for the purpose or for punishment of the way they treated natural Israel, persecuting them and then parting the land. Now those that bless the Jews and Israel will be blessed. And those that curse the seed of Abraham will be cursed. Well, how does the Lord view the Jews now before the mediatorial reign? And I think his attitude towards them is the attitude that we want to have. We read Joel 3, 1 through 3, where it spoke of the nations being punished because of what they did to my people. Before the mediatorial reign, the people of Israel are God's people. He owns them. Do we consider them God's people today? And then in Ezekiel 38, where you had the invasion of Gog, in verse 14, the Lord speaks of Gog. It says, are you come to my people Israel? And then in verse 16, he speaks of them coming against my people and against my land. This is before the mediatorial reign. The Lord certainly owns the people of Israel. They are His people. What is our attitude towards the people of Israel? Do we have the Lord's attitude? He that blesses the seed of Abraham will be blessed. Now, what is our message to the Gentiles concerning Israel? And that's the first page of our handout. The first scripture, Psalms 126, verses 1 through 3, was brought to my attention and to our attention. I say our attention, I'm speaking of those of you in the audience who were on our, what was it, the 96 mission, Comfort Mission to Israel. In the Knesset reception, one of the speakers that spoke to us was Hannah Parat. And he was and is the ideologist of the biblical Zionist in Israel. And he says, I want to tell you the real Hebrew meaning of Psalms 126, 1 through 3. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Israel, in other words, when the Lord was delivering Zion, we were like them that dreamt. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue was saying. He says, in the Hebrew, the thought is that we didn't know what it was all about. We were laughing, we were full of songs, but during our return, we didn't know what it was about, really. And then he says, it spoke of somebody saying something among the heathen, among the Gentiles. And what did they say? The Lord hath done great things for them, for the Jews and Israel. And he says, we heard what they were saying. And we said, yes, yes, that's what it's all about. The Lord is doing great things for us here in Israel. And he says, you people are the ones who have been telling the Gentiles what great things the Lord is doing for Israel in the land. Another scripture, Jeremiah 31:7. For thus saith the Lord, sing with gladness for Jacob, natural Israel, and shout among the chief of the nations, publish ye, praise ye, say, O Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. Here's a class that are not of Jacob, because they sing with gladness for Jacob, for Israel. And they have a message to the chief of the nations, where they feel the chief of the nations is the United States or the United Nations. But that message is like a prayer to the Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. And this is a message I feel, we feel, the church should be giving to the chief of the nations and all the nations, the Gentiles. Jeremiah 31, 10 and 11. Hear the word of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar, and say, he that scattereth Israel shall gather him and keep him as a shepherd does his flock. Who's going to give this message of what the Lord is doing on behalf of his people, Israel? Spiritual Israel is to give this message. And then Zechariah 12, 2 and 3. Behold, I will make Jerusalem like a cup of trembling unto all people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all people of the earth shall be gathered together against it. Who is going to give this warning to the nations who don't get involved in the problem of Jerusalem? If you do, you will be cut to pieces. We feel the Lord's people this time is to give this nation this message. Now, the Oslo Accords Remember, big signing ceremony on the White House lawn in 1939. 93, let's turn the 3 and the 9, switch them. 1993. Before Rabin would sign the Oslo Accords, he told Arafat, "You will have to put in writing a letter to me in which you promise that the PLO, that the Palestinians will cease forever their terrorism." No problem with Arafat. He wrote the letter. "We will no longer engage in terrorism." He sent it to Rabin. Rabin was at the White House lawn ceremony and signed the Oslo Peace Accords, which was to be a process by which peace would be brought in and the Arabs would be given a state in part of the land. You know, Arafat broke that promise. He made the promise again. He broke it again. He made the promise again. No more terrorism. He broke it again. For 10 years, there's still terrorism. You know what? After finally 10 years, it finally sunk in to the leaders of Israel and the leaders of the United States. You know, this fellow Arafat, he's a liar. And he was. Now, we have Bush's roadmap that guarantees two states in the land of Israel, a Palestinian state and a state of Israel for the Jews. Now, since his election, Bush has, in his second term, has cozied up to the new PLO leadership, and he pledges that the state of Israel, or rather the state of Palestine, will occupy all of Gaza and all of the West Bank, or Samaria and Judea, which some of us prefer to call the West Bank instead of the West Bank. Well, you know the old saying, meanwhile, back on the farm, but it happens to be Sharon's farm that we're talking about. Sharon and his two sons and his chief advisor decide to give up Gaza and four cities in North Samaria, or four cities in the north of the West Bank. Why? It's sad. It's very sad. Sharon and his two sons were about to be indicted for corruption, the swindling of several million dollars in a couple of different transactions throughout the world. It just happened that the left-wingers controlled the justice system, Justice Department or Ministry, and the court systems. And Sharon and his sons and his advisors figured that Sharon and his sons could avoid indictment if they pushed for disengagement from Gaza and from parts of the West Bank immediately. Now, just this week, this is the theory that has been developed for the last 2 years since 2003. Just last week, a new book has been published by two investigative reporters in Israel. They document all of this. The facts are all there. The IDF chief of staff, General Ya'alan, opposed Sharon on the disengagement plan. Well, he's no longer IDF chief of staff. But he said that when the Palestinians get Gaza and parts of the West Bank, they are going to be shooting rockets all over Israel proper, and a war is inevitable between the new Palestinian state and the nation of Israel. Brethren have asked me if I've ever had a meeting with Sharon. I did have with Rabin, and I did with Netanyahu. I blew that one. About 8 years ago, Sharon politically was going downhill fast. And I happened to spend a day with his PR man and guide who would take all the VIPs that came to visit Sharon around the country. And after the day with Aaron Pick, he said, how would you like to have a meeting with General Sharon? I said, well, you know, I really don't have much time. And in the back of my mind, I said, well, I should have a meeting with him. He's going out. So I said, no, I don't think I will. Well, instead of going out, he came up and he became prime minister. So I blew that one. You win some, you lose some. Now, disengagement from Gaza and North Samaria is scheduled to take place in August. Will it happen? I don't know. Israel's polls have dropped from 65% of the Israelis being for the disengagement to 48% of the Israelis, only 48%, less than 50% of the Israelis being for disengagement. Tens of thousands of settlers and sympathetic Israelis are threatening to prevent the disengagement by passive resistance. They threaten to shut down the whole country if Sharon attempts that disengagement. Well, will it happen? You know, a funny thing. What do they say? A funny thing happened on the way to the opera? A funny thing happened with Netanyahu. When the polls came down to 40% of the public, you know, Netanyahu just bets on a sure thing. I consider him an amoral person. And I'll get into that a little more. Although he voted for disengagement and sometimes abstained from voting, but he never opposed it. Now when the polls came down to 48% only of the Israelis for disengagement, he came out strongly against disengagement. But he got a little tricked because the next week it went up to 55%. So he got stuck in making an open statement. A little bit more about Netanyahu. You know, David Horowitz, who was a dear friend of Virginia and mine, perhaps he and his wife were closer to Virginia than they were to me, wrote a book about Pastor Russell, early Christian Zionist. And he had Netanyahu write a very favorable review for that book. In 1992 mission, we had our premier showing of Israel Appointment with Destiny at the La Rome Hotel in Jerusalem. Over 1,200 people were out. They had to shut the doors. It was standing room only. And we shared the platform with Netanyahu. And at that time, he was very enthusiastic for Brother Russell, his message, and our message. And he promised me that when he appeared, shared the platform, that he would make a very positive statement about Brother Russell's work and about our work that was going on, that the brethren were doing of comforting Israel. But he never did it. A few years later, I happened to be in Israel at a larger meeting, and an evangelical leader was there. He didn't realize my presence, and he was bragging to somebody how that back in 92, when Netanyahu was billed to appear with the Bible students on this occasion, the premier showing of Israel Appointment with Destiny, that the evangelical leaders approached him and they said, if you stop backing Russellism, we will back you with millions of dollars. He stopped backing Russellism. And to this day, he has the full support of the evangelicals. So again, as I say, you win some and you lose some. To show another one that we won, we had the privilege of being invited by the president of the Rabbinical Council of America, the largest Orthodox Rabbinical Council, to share the Shabbat service. It was in Memphis, Tennessee, one of the largest Orthodox congregations in the country. It just happened in Memphis that one of the evangelical leaders, actually the one that started the Moral Majority years ago, lived in Memphis, and he called Rabbi Grossman up. He says, Rabbi Grossman, do you realize you're having a Bible student at your synagogue? He said, yes, I know that. And the evangelical leader said, I wouldn't have a Bible student if I was you. I wouldn't trust him. Rabbi Grossman said to him, I would trust a Bible student before I would trust any evangelical Christian. So as I say, we win some and we lose some by the Lord's overruling. Now, who's to blame for the proposed withdrawal? Sharon? Yes. He has his vested interest in it. The Israeli public, who a large percentage of them are secular Jews? Yes. You know, about 8 years ago, I had a meeting with leaders of the biblical Zionists in Israel. And I said, stop the debate with these secular Israelis who want to compromise the land issue. And have an outreach to the secular Israelis to develop their faith in the Bible. And once they develop their faith in the Bible, you develop their faith in the Bible, they will automatically come around to the land issue, that all the land belongs to Israel. But instead of making this outreach to the secular Jews in Israel, they made an outreach to the evangelical Christians. And they thought with the millions of dollars that they could get from the evangelical Christians in developing the land, that they, with the evangelical Christians, independent of the citizens of Israel, would bring in the Messianic kingdom. But it hasn't worked, and it won't work, and the Lord won't let it work that way. Who else is responsible for the proposed land giveaway? Sad to say, biblical Zionists, Jews, in this country, and there are thousands and thousands of them, who daily are protesting about the giveaway of the land as they comfortably live in the United States. You know, in 1967, when Israel took the so-called West Bank, the biblical Jerusalem and Gaza, the Orthodox Jews, the biblical Zionists thought that was God's time clock striking. This was a message to us. Now, Judea and Samaria, the very heartland of Israel, has been returned to us to be inhabited, to be settled. And thousands of biblical Zionists settled in Judea and Samaria, in Gaza, but not enough. There are only 9,000 Jewish settlers in Gaza and 1 million Palestinian Arabs. Do you realize the amount of money it takes to defend those 9,000 Jewish settlers? It's driving Israel downhill economically. And this is why the secular Israelis are so much in favor of giving the land to the Palestinians. So I put the greater blame on the biblical Zionists around the world who have not recognized God's time clock striking for their return to Israel. They have not left their comfortable homes and their careers. If there were 500,000 Jews in Gaza, if there were 500,000 to 1 million Jews in Samaria and Judea, there would be no possibility of giving the land up in any degree. That's why the scriptures show the hunters will yet come to the United States and Russia and elsewhere where there are still Jews. And because of this, many other brethren react. And they said, well, if the Jews only had the faith, if they only went back to Israel, they would only leave their homes and their career. They're more interested in money. And if they would return to Israel, they wouldn't be in this mess. And this proves that, you know, how much is God dealing with them. Well, let's look at the faith of spiritual Israel, Christians. It is taking more than 2,000 years to find a mere 144,000 faithful Christians. Look at Bible students. The harvest has been going on for over 100 years. Crowns have been turning over. Taking all of this time for Bible students to make their calling and election sure. And yet, we say, where's the faith of the Jews? Why don't they go back? Well, it takes time to develop faith. God just doesn't drop it in anybody's head, just like he doesn't drop it into our heads. We as Christians have to develop it. On your handout, page 2, on the back of page 1, the back up, it says 5 million Jews in Russia. This was something that was found. I won't read that. You can read that article, newspaper article that they wrote about Professor Brandover's work. I won't even go through the details of it, but when his people in Russia found out that there are any place 3 to 5 million Jews yet. After the million left Russia between 1991 and 1998, I won't go into my meeting with Rabin on that, I've told that many times. 3 to 5 more million Jews in Russia. The gathering from the land of the north is not complete. And to verify this, the last time I was in Moscow, we had a meeting with Chief Rabbi Lazar. And I said, Rebbe, the official statistics are that there's about 700,000 Jews left in the former Soviet republics. How many are there really there? I think there must be more. Professor Brandmanover says there's more. He says, follow me. Took me into their computer department. And he says, we have in our computer database names of over 1 million, not individual Jews living in the former Soviet republics. Over 1 million families, names and addresses of over 1 million families living in the former Soviet republics. How many to a family? Two, three, more? He says there are at least over 3 million Jews left in the former Soviet republics. And we happen to be, and those involved in our work, in the work that of Message of Comfort, running a little battle with the Rabbi Lazar and other rabbis in the Soviet Union, former Soviet republics. They want to keep the Jews there. What happens if all the Jews come to Israel? They're out of their jobs. And we're having videos distributed there to get the Jews to leave Russia and the former Soviet republics. And they will leave by the Lord's leading. Now, I don't know how much land Israel will give up, if any. But we feel certain that the scriptures show that the peace process will break down into another Arab-Israel war. We will just give the scripture citations on this without an explanation because we've gone into this before. By the way, before we leave the immigration of Jews from the former Soviet republics, we'll just refer to Zechariah 10:10. It speaks of such a massive gathering from Egypt and Assyria that the land of Gilead, which is the east bank of the Jordan, where the nation of Jordan is, and Lebanon, and we feel southern Lebanon, will be filled with an exodus of Jews from Egypt and Assyria. Well, literal or symbolic Egypt and Assyria. Literal Egypt, there's about 200 to 400 Jews. Literal Assyria, Iraq, there's less than 100 Jews. How is this going to be such a massive exodus that it's going to overflow into Gilead and southern Lebanon? Well, we feel symbolic Egypt and symbolic Assyria. We feel that symbolic Assyria is Russia, and 3 million Jews at least are left in Russia yet. And symbolic Egypt is, you say, the world. But what world? The Christian world. And where do you have the greatest concentration of Jews in the Christian world? Right here in the United States. Over 5 million. That's why we feel the hundreds will yet come here. Okay, now back to the land. We feel there will be a future Arab-Israeli war. And by the way, I don't know if you have the book, our booklet, but it gives all the scriptures, the New Brunswick booklet, that will deal with this future Israel war. And the booklet is the Israel-Arab Peace Process and Bible Prophecy. Isaiah 11:14, Zephaniah 2, 4 through 7, and then 8 through 10, and Obadiah 20, show that Israel will get, in a future war, all of Gaza, all of the West Bank, and the East Bank, which is Jordan, and southern Lebanon up to Zarephath. Now we want to deal with a prophecy that fascinates brethren. And that's Jeremiah 30:14. And now we're getting into prophecies of the future. Of course, the future war is prophecy too. And as I said, we dialogue on this. And if it doesn't happen that way, it's going to be better. And all her lovers forsaken her is again something that's in the future. So we do that in dialogue. We won't take time to read Jeremiah 30:14. But the thing that has always bothered my mind about this, because most brethren feel this is going to happen sometime between now and before the invasion of Gog. What has bothered my mind is, during the time that her lovers forsake her, According to Jeremiah 30:14, Israel is committing some great transgression against the Lord. A great transgression. Well, about 8 years ago when I was reading Ezekiel 38 and 39 over for the umpteenth time, and this one we'll read, something just jumped out off the page in verses 25 and 26 of Ezekiel 39. Now when I deliver Jacob and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel and will be jealous for my holy name, after that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me when they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid. Well, when you read that phrase, when they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid, what do you think of? Immediately, verse 11 of chapter 38. And it's this time that it says that, well, the impact, verse 26 and verse 39, is that the invasion of Gog was to punish Israel for some great transgression she was committing when she dwelt safely in the land and was dwelling unafraid. So we go back to Jeremiah 38, verse 11. And it speaks of Gog. And thou shalt say, that is, Gog shall say, I will go down to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. What did I say? Thank you, dear. That's why I married you. She's a real helpmate. Thank you. Ezekiel 38:11. So they're dwelling peacefully in the land when God comes down. And chapter 39 of Ezekiel, the Lord is saying that, well, they're dwelling peacefully in the land, they're committing some great transgression, and that's why I have Gog down, come down and punish them. Well, what's the great transgression they are committing? Well, there's two sets of nations in Ezekiel 38. There's Gog in verses about 2 and 3, and Meshach and Tubal. These are all territories in Russia. And then verses 5 and 6 delineate other nations that will be associated with Gog and this invasion. But then down in verse 13, you have a second set of nations that aren't in Gog's force. Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil, as thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil. We're not going to get into what the spoil is. But this second set of nations, symbolized by Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, seem to be already down in Israel. And they're saying to Gog, are you come to take a spoil? Now, why are they down there already? And who are they? We feel, well, the merchants of Tarshish is Spain, and it says the merchants of Tarshish and the young lions thereof. Spain was the first imperialistic nation of Christendom that traveled the seas with world commerce, and followed by the young lions thereof, Great Britain, and now the United States. And the focus is on the young lions thereof, the modern states of Christendom that are carrying on commerce. And Sheba and Dedan, whatever else they were great commercial centers. So we feel that verse 13 are emblematic of the Western powers, the Western capitalist countries. And why are they down in Israel at the invasion of Gog, saying, why are you come to take a spoil? Why are you coming down here? we feel that, and this is speculation, we feel that the reason Israel will be dwelling in an unwalled condition is that after the next Israel-Arab war, and Israel has extended boundaries, which were predicted in very phraseology, predicted in Micah 7. They're bound, this is the day of the extending of their boundaries. That the Western powers reluctantly will recognize these new boundaries, but they're going to say, enough is enough. We're going to demilitarize the whole Middle East, because every time there's a crisis in the Middle East, it threatens another world war. And you say, well, Israel would never agree to that. Israel's going to fight its own wars. Well, who was the greatest hawk prime minister in the history of Israel? Prime Minister Shamir. And during the Gulf War, well, Iraq was shooting missiles into Israel, and Israel wanted to fight back. And Bush Senior, who was president, he says, no, we're going to fight for you. Shamir says, okay. So we feel that Israel will submit to this demilitarization with the guarantee that the Western powers will guarantee her borders. That's why, verse 13, there are forces of the Western capitalistic powers in Israel at the time of this invasion to protect Israel's boundaries. But who will these Western powers be at that time? Well, some of us believe that denominational churches will have come to power. Church-state union by that time. So here Israel will be entrusting her security to Babylon. What an abomination this will be to the Lord. This will be the great trespass that Israel will be committing when she dwells safely in the land in unwalled villages. Well, how do her lovers forsake her? How do the Western powers forsake Israel? They see Gog coming down. To make a long story short, we feel that the revolution of Revelation 16, the masses rising up against the church-state system, will have begun. And remember in Ezekiel 38, God puts a hook in Gog's jaw and turns him around and brings him down to Israel. Russia at that time would say, oh boy, this is the time to go and take Western Europe. We never had an opportunity like this. They're about to be in the throes of a revolution. But the Lord will turn them around and bring them down to Israel. And when the Western powers of verse 13 see God coming down, they will go for the spoil themselves. Why should we, protect Israel? We'll take the spoil before God gets it, and we can then refinance our governments back in Europe and the United States, or that are starting to be in the throes of revolution. So that's how we feel that the lovers will forsake her, and that's the time we feel they will forsake her. Now we're going to stop our talk on Israel and turn to your handout. Failure is never final. As I say, I wanted to use this yesterday on the panel. We didn't have time. This is something I put together a few years ago when I was very discouraged. And I hope it's something that will be helpful to you. Failure is never final if the past year, month, or week might have been a partial failure, even a complete failure. But remember, tomorrow is the first day of the rest of your new creature life. If there is sorrow or pain in your heart, don't suppress it. Do your grieving now. Face, accept, and resolve your pain. Get up, even if you have to drag yourself up, and go on. To do this effectively, there are several valuable qualities you need to have. One, give God a chance. If you feel like you have failed and believe you've done wrong, ask God to forgive you. And be sure to forgive yourself. Then turn your failure into a stepping stone in your development as a new creature. Use your failure as David did to gain insights into your fallen human nature so that you will be able to understand and help others now and in the kingdom. Psalms 51. Also have a right attitude. Attitude is what makes the difference between a painful experience becoming a failure or a success. You can let the failure leave you timid and afraid to step out again for fear of being hurt, or you can determine that your failure will be your teacher. You can allow your failures to hurt you or help you. True, you need mountaintop experiences from time to time to keep your encouragement or to give you encouragement. But you don't grow through these. It is only in the valley of your disappointments and through your failures that you are given the opportunity to take stock of your new creature life and move forward to a greater level of growth and maturity. Also, remember that failure is an event, not a person. Because you may have failed in your marriage or job, in another relationship, or other situation in the narrow way, doesn't mean that you are a failure as a person. Not at all. Realize that the only real failure is not to try, and not to keep on trying, and not to get up one more time. The important thing is to learn from your past, to use it as an opportunity to grow and to move ahead. Remember, a just man falls 7 times, but rises up again. Proverbs 24:16. When a bone is broken and healed, that healed break becomes the strongest part of the bone. The same is true of your broken or failed experiences. When you have been hurt, have fallen and failed, or are afraid, when you bring these to God for His healing, His strength is made perfect in your weakness. God bless you all. We love you all.